These are American Stories from the Washington Post. I'm editor David Finkel, here with some of the Post's most compelling stories about the issues that unite us and divide us. What are the boundary lines in the United States of America? These stories will help answer that question. Part 5 in our series is a story by Stephanie McCrumman called In Chiron, Iowa, Population 229, The Meaning of a Life, a Death, and Another Cup of Coffee. It's a bittersweet tale of friendship and isolation in rural America. Here's Stephanie to tell you more.
Hi, this is Stephanie McCrumman. I'm a reporter on the National Enterprise team for The Washington Post. So the story I wrote is really about a dying town, one of many dying towns across Iowa and across the U.S. And the main character in the story is a gentleman named Russell Paulson. The origin of the story really was something that Congressman Steve King said back in March that drew a lot of attention, a lot of criticism. He was talking about the future of the U.S. and Steve King, who's really known for his very hardline stance against illegal immigration, said that you cannot rebuild your civilization with somebody else's babies. And this comment was widely interpreted to be an anti-immigration statement. It was very controversial. And so as we were thinking about what he said, we were thinking about really not so much writing about Steve King, but trying to understand the people who elected Steve King. And as it turns out, those people are mostly white, mostly older, and they're people who live in a lot of tiny little towns in Iowa. We weren't sure where we wanted to go, but we knew that we wanted to go to a place that really was representative of his district. We identified a couple towns, and one of those was Chiron. And after spending some time there and coming upon this group of men who had coffee every day at this gas station, we thought that would be a pretty good place to spend some time and try to get to a deeper understanding of what this place was about. Many of these people may not agree exactly with everything that Steve King says, but at the same time, they identify with him very strongly. They feel they know him, he's familiar. As one of them said, you know, if Steve King was sitting here drinking coffee, he'd be just like us. You wouldn't tell the difference. At the same time, many of these men who had coffee, you know, expressed some differences of opinion with his position. So it's kind of interesting that one could say in a way that maybe Steve King is a more extreme version of his constituents. This story is an American story because it's about a place in this country, a vanishing place that in some ways represents a demographic trend. This country is becoming less white, less homogenous, less of some of the things that have been so familiar to these men that we spent time talking to. I was really surprised by the reception to this story. I got so many emails from people who live in towns like Chiron saying that they appreciated how the story did not try to judge a way of life, but rather just tried to describe it. One thing that I like about this story and like about these types of stories is that they're not stories where I, as a reporter, am going to a place and putting a microphone into someone's face, as it were, and asking them to state their positions on various political questions. This kind of story is about going to a place and listening and spending time there and observing and trying to understand how people live their life. Because how people live their life, how they talk to each other, really, I think, gets at something more essential about who they are and about who we are and about this moment in a way that simply asking someone what their position is on immigration sometimes misses.
In Chiron, Iowa, population 229, The Meaning of a Life, a Death, and Another Cup of Coffee. Written by Stephanie McCrumman, April 16, 2017. Chiron, Iowa. Russell Paulson had already heard, by the time he arrived at the Quick Mart for his afternoon coffee, Walt Miller had died. "Died last night, huh?" someone was saying as Russell pulled up a chair. "Yeah, last night," another man said. Russell listened. He had known Walt, At the age of 80, he knew almost everyone in Chiron, a town of 229 people, one of whom is U.S. Representative Steve King, who has a house on the edge of town. Russell knew King, too, knew that he was the sort of person always stirring controversy, often by raging against what he called cultural suicide by demographic transformation. More recently, King had said that we can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies, a comment embraced by prominent white supremacists and widely condemned around the country as demonizing Latino and other non-European immigrants. There was little controversy across King's district, though, a swath of rural America made up of tiny towns with tiny, aging white populations that routinely elected King with more than 70% of the vote. In Chiron, people brushed it off as King being King, a man they all knew, expressing a plain truth they all understood. The white population was shrinking, and towns like theirs were vanishing, with the few exceptions being places such as Denison, a pork processing town 20 minutes down the highway, where population growth was being driven by immigrants from Mexico and Central America. Chiron, meanwhile, was losing steam. According to the most recent census figures, the population included 9 Mexicans. The other 220 were all white, and their numbers were decreasing by 10 or so each year, and now, on a Wednesday, by 1. "Oh, Walt Miller, he did pass?" Dwayne Swenson, 67, said, sipping his coffee. "What do you have, pancreatic cancer or something?" said Ron Streck, 70. "Liver," said Herman Knuckamp, also 70. "I think that's what it was, wasn't it, Russell?" "I knew he passed, but I didn't know any details," Russell said. It was a quiet afternoon, the ritual 3 p.m. coffee in a place where, as one regular put it, you can figure out Steve King by understanding all of us. Every day but Sunday, the bell on the front door rang as they arrived. The wood-paneled back room was waiting, the bun-o-matic and the styrofoam cups, the space heater humming. The clock with the squinting merit cigarette man on one wall, the calendar on the other, the cracked blinds dangling over the window where the view through the slats was a sea of farm fields. And on a hill in the distance, a stand of evergreens, where the cemetery was. Now the bell on the front door rang again, and Russell looked up. "Oh," Ron said under his breath, seeing who it was. "Here comes trouble." It was Kevin Lloyd, 52, who came in occasionally and had been in the day before, all riled up about the latest Steve King situation, waving his hands and going on about how people had misunderstood what he'd meant about other people's babies. "If you're American, you got to take care of America," he had said then. "I love that people want to come here from Mexico, from Ukraine, from the Middle East, but they need to come here legally." Dwayne, Ron, a woman named Jane Grono, and Russell had been there, sipping their coffees, as Kevin had continued that he had no idea why people would call King a white supremacist, or for that matter, why people would call President Trump racist. "Now, is Barack Hussein Obama a Muslim, in my opinion? Yes," he had said. And that had brought him to the other thing he figured King meant about babies. He had meant Muslim babies of the Muslims that Obama had allowed into the country. "And here I'm going to quote a great president, Abe Lincoln," he had said. He said the fall of America will come from the inside. Well, if you're allowing all these children in, and if they hate America, how long is it going to be before we're not the United States of America anymore? Jane had nodded. "If you study the number of Muslims, there are going to be so many here, and they're going to have so many kids, they're going to be able to take over that way." Dwayne had nodded. "They say freedom of religion, but if you're Muslim and you become Christian, you're ousted. Sometimes they kill him. They behead him," Kevin had said, into a quiet Iowa afternoon. "I think what King was trying to get across is, look, we can only grow so many hogs, so much beans and so much corn," Kevin had said. "If we let everybody in, we're going to be without a food source. And what happens when that's gone? Then we're all in trouble." Chaos, beheadings, starvation, the death of one America and the rise of another. That was the trouble Kevin had raised the day before, and now he was back, interrupting the conversation about Walt Miller. "What are you up to, Mr. Paulson?" he said to Russell. "Just listening and learning," Russell said, looking at the floor, holding his coffee. "Every once in a while, I learn something here. Every once in a while, I learn something about myself." "So how old was Walt?" Ron continued.
"Mid-60s, I'd say," said Herman.
"Died last night," Ron said again.
"Last night," Herman said again.
After a while, Russell asked,
I wasn't sure if he was home. Yeah, he was at home, Herman said, and Russell was quiet the rest of the afternoon. The next day, Russell had his morning coffee and got into his car. He stopped by the bank, where he'd been going since the 1940s. Hi, Russell, the one teller said to her one customer. He got back into his car and drove one block to the edge of town, turned onto the two-lane highway, then one long gravel road after another, straight lines stretching out into still fallow fields. Some of the roads have been abandoned, he said. Because there's not as many people living out here, the roads just disappeared. He knew the roads better than anyone. His own family's roots in the area stretched back to the 19th century, when the U.S. government was aggressively removing Native American tribes to make way for one of the largest immigration waves in American history. The Swedes came, the Germans came, the farms, the towns, and generations of babies, one of whom was Russell Elmer Paulson, born in 1937. He was raised on his mother's family farm in rural Chiron and never left, other than a stint in the army and one in Dubuque. It wasn't for me, he said, driving along. He and his wife Glenda inherited land when Russell's parents died and lived on it until they retired and moved into town. Russell's work had been farming and insurance adjusting. His culture was being a Methodist and a Mason and listening to polka, though most of that had fallen away. The church he and Glenda had gone to died for lack of people and money, he said. There were hardly any Masons left. Polka was not enjoying a revival. His kids had left for jobs in other areas. Glenda had died last year. See that ridge? That's the old railroad bed, he said now, driving along, squinting through his gold-rimmed glasses. My aunt bought this, he said, passing a stand of trees where farmhouses had been. Walt would go there, he said, pointing out a repair shop where Walt Miller had coffee. And soon he turned onto a narrow dirt road leading to the farm where he and Glenda had lived, a collection of storage buildings where Russell now kept his old tractors, and one he used as an office, where he went these days to work crossword puzzles or just sit and think. Commune with God and the birds, he said. Well, not too many birds now. He glanced around at the old buildings, now shuttered and locked, though someone had broken into one of them recently. They stole a bunch of tools and such, Russell said, pulling back onto the gravel road. No need to get all worked up about it. He had a huge bag of peppermint lifesavers on the console, and he unwrapped one and put it in his mouth. He passed a rotting barn and a bird on a stretch of barbed wire, and after a while, a gray house with a huge American flag. This is Steve King's house here, he said, looking at it. He had known King a long time, and saw no reason to be bothered by something or other he said. He supported King. I have no reason in the world to dislike the man, but wasn't one to rant about politics. He had no computer, no smartphone, his television had no cable. He watched a half hour of national news, a half hour of local, followed by Wheel of Fortune and Lawrence Welk. He ate chicken tenders and food he described as American. He's just kind of one of us, Russell said of King, driving on past a field where a church had burned down and the home of a man who died last year. It began to rain. When it comes down like it's doing now, it's just wonderful, he said. He drove past fields and more fields until he came to another stand of trees on a hill. This is the cemetery, he said, pulling in. He drove slowly past the headstones. A lot of these people I knew, he said, and began reading names. Larson, Lind, Gustafson, Paulson. This would be my folks right here, he said, and then he noticed the time. Almost 3 p.m. He headed back to town, pulling onto Main Street where a wooden sign said, Chiron, blessed with the best. After King had made his comment about babies, some out-of-town protest group had put up another sign below that one that said, White Supremacist. The sign didn't make any sense to Russell, and after it was removed, his main worry was that the protesters might have damaged the town sign, which had started to rot a few years ago. Russell had taken on the job of maintaining it. He had trimmed the tree branches that had grown through the wood. He had taken down Blessed with the Best and repainted each of the letters. He went to a lumber yard and had a new K-I-R-O-N made, painting each letter several times and spraying them with wood preservative. One year, he and Glenda had planted a bed of petunias and geraniums. I don't think we will ever have a better display of flowers, he said now, and soon he was pulling up to the Quick Mart for the afternoon coffee. As he walked inside, he saw a funeral notice on the front door with a photo of a smiling man in gold-rimmed glasses. "Oh," Russell said, pausing for a moment. "There's Walt." He glanced at the funeral information for Walt Miller, poured his fourth coffee of the day, and sat down in the back room. Dwayne and Charlie Harm were already there, but they weren't talking. A car swooshed by. An 18-wheeler swooshed by. Charlie tapped his nails on the table. The next day, the bell rang as the door with the funeral notice swung open, and it was Dwayne, then Bob James, then Herman, then Russell. The Merritt cigarette clock showed a few minutes after 3 p.m. Russell got the coffee pot and poured. The bell rang again, and it was a man named Glenn Ballantyne. "Time for plowing?" Herman asked the 84-year-old farmer. "2 weeks," Glenn said, sitting down. Bob was reading the paper. Russell was sipping his coffee, looking out the window. "Got the visitation tonight," Herman said. He didn't have to mention Walt Miller's name because they all knew what he meant. They went back to talking about plowing, and Glenn was saying how different farming was now than when he was a young man, which for some reason reminded him of one of his first jobs, digging graves. "For $18, he said. "You dug a regular grave for $18, said Dwayne. "Oh yeah, and we had to fill them back up again," said Glenn. "I helped dig one once," said Russell. "You know, manually. Only one. I don't know what I got paid, but that's a long way down to the bottom of that." "If there was frost in the first foot, you got $1 more," said Glenn. "What'd you use to get through the frost?" asked Bob. "Pickaxe and sledgehammer," said Glenn. "And when we'd fill them in 14 scoops. We were just little kids, more or less. We had more dirt than we needed," Russell said, "and had to haul that away," said Glenn, finishing his sentence. "Had to put that on the pickup," said Russell. And they went on talking like that until Herman got up to leave. It was after 3:30 p.m. "Funeral home starts, what, at 4? Herman said. 4 till 7, it says on there," Russell said. The funeral home was in Denison, and the sun was going down as Russell turned onto the two-lane highway toward one of the only towns in Steve King's district that was growing, and which appeared in the distance as a cluster of lights and rising steam from the pork processing plant. Russell turned by the Walmart, bustling on a Friday payday, and turned again into a neighborhood where Latino kids were playing in a yard. Up a hill, he parked in front of the funeral home, where people were still streaming in near 7 p.m. Russell made his way through the receiving line, his hat off, comb lines visible in his gray hair. He shook hands with Walt's family, who thanked him for coming, and inched forward until he reached the open casket. He stood there a moment. He looked at Walt. He looked at the light blue satin lining and the farm scene etched into it. A man stood next to Russell. "Went fast," he said of Walt, who had passed away soon after his diagnosis. "That's what you hope for." "I do," said Russell, still looking at Walt. And soon, he headed back to Chiron. The funeral was the next day at Zion Lutheran Church in Denison, and more people came from Chiron and other vanishing towns like Odebolt and Ida Grove. They sat in jeans and dresses and suits on the wooden pews of a church founded in 1872 and read about Walt and the program, where it was said that farming and fixing equipment and household items were his favorite things to do. And soon the church bells began ringing. The pews creaked as everyone stood and watched the pallbearers roll in the coffin draped in a white cloth with a red cross, and a procession of dozens of family members that included exactly one baby, a girl with a black ribbon around her head. "Your world has changed," the pastor began. When it was over, people got back into their cars and drove 20 minutes up the highway to the cemetery in Chiron. A long procession of headlights passing through fields and more fields, then turning right, then heading up the hill to the stand of evergreens, and afterward at 3 p.m., the bell on the Quick Mart door began ringing. It rang for Herman, who arrived with a loaf of homemade bread. It rang for Dwayne, for Bob, and for Charlie, who shuffled into the back room and said, "Buried a nice guy this morning." It rang for Russell, who poured his coffee, walked back into the wood-paneled room, and pulled up a chair. "Strawberries come to life this time of year, Russell?" Dwayne asked. "I don't know," Russell said. They talked about the frost and when spring might arrive. "Well, I better get moving," Charlie said and headed out. I got things to do too, Russell said. But then he didn't leave. Not yet. He got up and sat where Charlie had been, closer to the window. Well, I gotta go, Herman said. See you, Herman, Russell said. Bye, Herman, Dwayne said. And now there were just the three of them left. Dwayne cleared his throat. A car passed by. The space heater hummed. Bob finished his coffee. Russell swallowed the last of his. You want more coffee, Mr. Bob? Russell asked. Do you? Said Bob. Yeah, Russell decided, and walked over to get the coffee pot. He poured some into Bob's cup. He poured some into Dwayne's cup. He filled his own and sat down again. He tapped his thumb on the table. Eventually, he stood up and walked toward the door, where Walt's funeral notice no longer was. See you, Russell, said Dwayne. See you, Russell, said Bob. I hope so, Russell said.
That was In Chiron, Iowa, Population 229, The Meaning of a Life, a Death, and Another Cup of Coffee, written by Stephanie McCrumman and published April 16, 2017. It was read by Carl Miller and produced by Curio, and with additional mixing and original music by Ted Muldoon.